On this week's 51%, the U.S. President and Vice President announced a campaign to help put an end to sexual assault on college campuses.
Never is it appropriate for a woman to ask, "What did I do?" The question is, why was that done to me? And will someone do something about it?
You'll hear about a study focused on female college students and sexual assault. Plus, we'll hear from actress Swoosie Kurtz about her memoir. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%.
We all came from a woman, got our name from a woman, and I came from a woman. I wonder why we take from our women, why we rape our women, do we hate our women? I think it's time to kill for our women, time to heal our women. Be real.
The first semester is in full swing for college students across the U.S. In mid-September at the White House, President Barack Obama joined Vice President Joe Biden to launch the It's On Us initiative, an awareness campaign to help put an end to sexual assault on college campuses. Here's Biden.
It's on all of us to change the culture that asks the wrong questions. And our culture still asks the wrong questions. It is never the right question for a woman to ask, "What did I do?" Never. Get this straight, never is it appropriate for a woman to ask, "What did I do?" The question is, why was that done to me? And will someone do something about it?
He says the mark of success will be when not a single woman blames herself. And he has a message for men.
Step up, be responsible, intervene. You have an obligation to make a pariah of those on campus who abuse another person. That's how we can change this culture. Apply the moral disapprobation of society and the community on any man who raises his hand. And understand, no means no. In the classroom, in a car, on the campus, in a bedroom, no means no. So step up, you guys. Speak out.
Biden delivered his words after hearing from Lily J.
Getting into college is hard. Getting your college back, reclaiming it as your own after sexual assault, is nearly impossible. I was raped just a few weeks into my freshman year. I pantomimed learning and watched educational opportunities slip away. The day I found out that the student who had raped me raped someone else, I filed a disciplinary complaint. I joined survivors across the country in announcing our truth. And activism seemed like a promising antidote to the loneliness of surviving assault. But the truth is, it didn't help me reclaim college. Because whether you're thinking about it because you're scared of the boy down the hall, or because you're planning a meeting with the college president, recalling rape always hurts. That's the terrible irony of sexual assault activism. Using your experience to protect others from rape is so empowering and so important, but it also tethers you to your pain. In order to be heard, I had to talk about the night in which violence silenced me. When non-survivors step up and say, "I don't need to be hurt to care about assault," they give survivors permission to move our hearts from the edge of our sleeve back to where it belongs. Hearing my friends and professors say, "You don't need to stay hurt for us to take this seriously," freed me to finally mourn for my freshman self. And that's when I got my college back. Allies do more than prevent future assault. They help carry the heavy truth that colleges can and should be safer. Only together can we ensure that when we look back, we can say, it was compassion, not trauma, that changed the world.
Obama announced the launch of the It's On Us campaign.
It's not on you. This is not your fight alone. This is on all of us, every one of us, to fight campus sexual assault. You are not alone, and we have your back, and we are going to organize campus by campus, city by city, state by state. This entire country is going to make sure that we understand what this is about, and that we're going to put a stop to it.
President Obama, whose oldest daughter is 2 years away from entering college, says the following statistics prove the need to end campus sexual assault.
An estimated 1 in 5 women has been sexually assaulted during her college years. 1 in 5. Of those assaults, only 12% are reported. And of those reported assaults, only a fraction of the offenders are punished. And while these assaults overwhelmingly happen to women, we know that men are assaulted too. Men get raped. They're even less likely to talk about it. We know that sexual assault can happen to anyone, no matter their race, their economic status, sexual orientation, gender identity. And LGBT victims can feel even more isolated. Feel even more alone.
He commends the progress made with respect to the issue, but says progress can only go so far until a fundamental shift in approach occurs.
As far as we've come, the fact is that from sports leagues to pop culture to politics, our society still does not sufficiently value women. We still don't condemn sexual assault as loudly as we should. We make excuses. We look the other way. The message that sends can have a chilling effect on our young women. And I've said before, when women succeed, America succeeds. Let me be clear, that's not just true in America. If you look internationally, countries that oppress their women are countries that do badly. Countries that empower their women are countries that thrive. And so this is something that that requires us to shift how we think about these issues. You know, one letter from a young woman really brought this point home. Catherine Morrison, a young student from Youngstown, Ohio. She wrote, "How are we supposed to succeed when so many of our voices are being stifled? How can we succeed when our society says that as a woman, it's your fault if you are at a party or walked home alone? How can we succeed when people look at women and say, you should have known better, or boys will be boys?" And Catherine's absolutely right. Women make up half this country, half its workforce, more than half of our college students. They are not going to succeed the way they should unless they are treated as true equals and are supported and respected. And unless women are allowed to fulfill their full potential, America will not reach its full potential. So we got to change. And this is not just the work of survivors, it's not just the work of activists, it's not just the work of college administrators. It's a responsibility of the soccer coach and the captain of the basketball team and the football players. And it's on fraternities and sororities, and it's on the editor of the school paper and the drum major in the band. And it's on the English department and the engineering department, and it's on the high schools and the elementary schools, and it's on teachers, and it's on counselors, and it's on mentors, and it's on ministers. It's on celebrities and sports leagues and the media to set a better example. And it's on parents and grandparents and older brothers and sisters to sit down, young people, and talk about this issue.
He adds,
"And it's not just on the parents of young women to caution them. It is on the parents of young men to teach them respect for women."
He says the NCAA, Big Ten conferences, MTV, VH1, and a few others have already made a commitment to help stop sexual assault.
The first step on this is to go to itsonus.org. That's itsonus.org. Take a pledge to help keep women and men safe from sexual assault. It's a promise not to be a bystander to the problem, but to be part of the solution. I took the pledge. Joe took the pledge. You can take the pledge. You can share it on social media. You can encourage others to join us. And this campaign is just part of a broader effort, but it's a critical part, because even as we continue to enforce our laws and work with colleges to improve their responses and to make sure that survivors are taken care of, it won't be enough unless we change the culture that allows assault to happen in the first place.
That was President Obama, Vice President Biden, and Lilly talking about the need to put an end to sexual assault on college campuses via the It's On Us awareness campaign. Meanwhile, a study out of the University at Buffalo's Research Institute on Addictions says female college students of past sexual assaults are at a much higher risk of becoming victims again. In this Focus on Education report, WBFO's Eileen Buckley talks to the principal investigator of the study.
It's never a woman's fault for being victimized. I don't care if she's passed out drunk. I don't care if she's walking naked down the street. It's never, ever, ever her fault for being victimized.
Kathleen Parks is a senior research scientist at UB's RIA. The results of this study say a campus female who was a victim of a past sexual assault is three times more likely to have it happen again.
And then the other thing that we've found is when we look at the temporal relationship, so the relationship on a daily level between drinking and victimization, we do find that drinking predicts victimization on a daily level.
The study followed nearly 1,000 college women, mainly 18 to 21 years of age, over a five-year period. That included their drinking habits, as well as experiences of severe physical and sexual assaults.
So I think what it highlights for us is that looking out for women during those first couple of years is really important. Those are the years when they're most vulnerable.
Past research by Parks shows freshmen have a higher risk of being assaulted if they binge drink. During a recent visit to UB's South Campus in Buffalo, WBFO News spoke with second-year student Megan Messner about freshmen arriving on campus and drinking too much.
It is very scary, and I mean, that's definitely something undergrad, grad school, like, it's always going to, you know, you're going to party and you're going to see bad things happening, and it's scary, but you just got to look out for your friends.
With the recent spotlight on campus assaults nationwide, researcher Park says this study shows campuses must be aware of the increased risk.
Women who are so early to come to campuses and experience these horrible things necessarily know how to access the services that would help them avoid PTSD or additional negative experiences or consequences that result from the trauma.
But Parks reiterated that they're not blaming the victim.
That was Eileen Buckley reporting from Buffalo, New York.
Tell me one more time, you gotta get you some of that. Sure, I'll slide on over, but you're gonna get slapped. Huh. These days it ain't easy being mad. Girl in a country song, how in the world did it go so wrong?
Multiple Tony, Emmy, Obie, and Drama Desk Award winner Swoosie Kurtz is a Broadway icon whose work also includes movies like Liar Liar and Dangerous Liaisons, along with television hits Pushing Daisies and Mike and Molly. She is the author of Part Swan, Part Goose, an uncommon memoir of womanhood, work, and family. Her life has become a precarious and precious balancing act as she struggles to stay ahead of her mother Margot's increasing needs while navigating a showbiz career that keeps one foot in Hollywood and the other on Broadway. Swoosie Kurtz spoke with 51%'s Joe Donahue. This is part two of a two-part interview.
You have a great line in the book that even though you come from this great family, you're an only child, you had wonderful parents, and yet you say, you make the point that you have a therapist and say that, you know, even if you're going to be in Hollywood, you almost have to have a therapist.
Yeah.
That's a standard issue.
Right, right.
Because there's always the things that you have to work out.
Well, you know, everybody should have a therapist. I'm lucky to be able to have one. You know, you have to be crazy to begin with to be in show business. So that's established already that I'm crazy. And she is so insightful. She's read Margot's book years ago, and she knows Margot. And she never met my dad, but she will come out with these startling bits of insight. One time she said to me, well, it seems like the only thing missing from your childhood was a child. And I went, oh, my God. Because we were like three adults together. I was always treated as an adult. And my opinion was always valued. And my preferences were always valued. I always felt heard and listened to. Not in a precocious or precious way. Just like, yeah, I was worth... You know, my opinion counted for something. I think because we moved around so much, I would try to make friends, but then I was plucked out of one place and we traveled to another place and plunked down into a new group of people, which incidentally was the best training in the world for this life I have now,
right,
which has absolutely no continuity in terms of the work. But I think I was probably thrown back on my parents much more because of this, you know, kind of difficulty of making friends for any amount of time. So we just were the three of us together, our merry band of three.
Do you believe that it has an effect on you as an actor because it gives you a confidence?
I think it definitely does. I think I was thrown back on my imagination to create, to entertain myself, because I, also being an only child and also being kind of this nomadic life with them, and I didn't have tons of playmates or sisters and brothers around me all the time, so I would make up things. I remember playing Monopoly and all by myself, but I'd set out the board and I'd have three other imaginary friends there, you know, and one was, I got to watch out for this guy. He'll hide the money under the table and he's a real cheat, you know, and somebody else would be like really dumb about money and not be able to add it up. So I would make up these different personalities. Of course, I would play them all. And then there was me, which was never as interesting as those other colorful characters. I just wanted to be somebody else.
And not being overly psychological, but even in the book, it seems as though you paint your parents as much more interesting, perhaps, than yourself.
Well, it's interesting. Yeah, because I didn't really want my story. You know, that was not my passion, to tell my story. I really wanted to tell about them. Mm. But the book, you know, contains my whole life and my whole career.
I was surprised. I didn't realize that you were just 17 when you first were on television with Donna Reed.
Was I 17? Oh, yeah. But then there were all those years of unemployment after that before I actually got my first grown-up job.
And at what point did you know that you wanted it to be your job?
When I was in high school. I wanted to be a prima ballerina before that. But in high school, I was in this amazing acting class at Hollywood High, believe it or not, with this man called John Engel, who was a legendary drama teacher there. And he really lit the fire for me. I did a scene in class and I had that eureka in the bathtub moment where I became someone else and I connected with the audience, with the class, you know, so much, with so much more clarity and excitement than I could ever relate one-on-one in life.
I became familiar with your work through, I guess first, through Love, Sydney.
Oh, yeah.
Which was a fascinating, reading back on it and reading about it now is even more fascinating than because I had forgotten
right.
The uproar of the time of a gay character on television.
I know.
You, Tony Randall.
And My Little Girl.
Yes.
Yeah, how crazy is that? That we forget, you know, with the freedom we have now on television and film. It's hard to believe. It was the early 80s, and it was the first show that ever had a gay character on it. It was on NBC, and Tony was adamant that we maintain that the character's gay, you know, and he really fought the good fight. But the affiliates started pulling out before they had ever even seen anything. They just heard about it. And it was tough, but we went on for two seasons. And it was a really good show.
It was a good show. Although it was sort of de-gayed at some point.
It was de-gayed, and he just became a happy bachelor.
Do you look for, it seems now with your family on Mike and Molly, you write about it at the beginning of this book, that is that what you, that you ultimately strive for, is to find those situations where you can set for a while and be in a good environment?
You mean in terms of a job?
Yes.
Well, you know, I didn't plan it. It's not something I strived for. I think as an actor, you just, it's kind of pathetic, but you sort of just take what comes your way. Your only real power as an actor is to say no. And the choices that you make, you know, determine your career. And I just feel I didn't really have that much choice in the matter. I was so lucky, so blessed, the things that have dropped into my lap, and Mike and Molly being the most current and one of the biggest and longest lasting ones. But I didn't plan it. I'll tell you what was so great, though, about the last few years taking care of Margot is pushing daisies and Mike and Molly. For these things to come up, it was like, thank you, God. You know, wow. Because it's 4 minutes from my house. Mm. And to be that close to her when she really needed me and not have a play come up in New York that I absolutely had to do, I was so thankful because every play that came across my desk, I'd say, well, please don't let this be the one. Because, you know, if you read it and you go, I have to do this play, then you just work it out. I was relieved every time it wasn't the one and I could stay with her.
You mentioned Pushing Daisies, but what a wonderful character.
Oh, God. That show, I'm so proud to be. I feel like I was a little tiny part of a little tiny part of television history.
It was a jewel.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
We talked to Jim Dale recently about his participation in the program, and he was saying it's just, it was, creating that perfection made it so expensive, which made it so difficult to mm-hmm. to produce on a regular basis. But it was so fascinating.
It was magical.
And you were wonderful at it.
Thank you. Thank you. It was a great character. And just to play on that, and Brian Fuller's mind, his playground, was extraordinary.
With all of that said, do you still keep an eye to the theater? Do you still look to New York and say?
For sure. Oh, yeah, for sure, because that's my dream, is to come back and do a play. But, you know, doing a play is a huge commitment. Everything is sacrificed on the altar of performance. Some people can manage to do all kinds of things while they're doing a play. I'm not one of them. I live like a nun. I eat like a nun. I sleep like, you know, when I'm in a play, it's that stamina for eight a week. You know, it's just, you just have to do it. It's not something where you can phone it in. It's got to be the first time, every time you do it, because that audience has never seen it before.
You are so adept at both comedy and drama.
Thank you.
Is that difficult for you or very natural?
It's very natural. I don't know how that happens, but it's a joy to me. And, you know, beyond my wildest dreams, this dream of mine has come true, to become other people. And to make someone laugh or make someone cry or move them in some way is the most thrilling experience. It's such a high. I mean, it's like a drug. Once you've had it, you have to have more of it. So that's, I think, with all of the awful side of this business and the sort of all the other side of it, you know, you live for those moments, which are just beyond thrilling. To make that connection with another human being, with an audience, and to feel something land, whether it's a laugh or a gasp, just this that connection is electric.
That was 51%'s Joe Donahue speaking with actress Swoosie Kurtz about her book, Part Swan, Part Goose, an uncommon memoir of womanhood, work, and family. Part one of the interview appeared in show number 1314. And that's our show for this week. I'm looking forward to connecting with you again next week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Chartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again or visit the 51% archives, go to our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1315.